To the Matatang Sumunya. I'm Alan Hallowell. Welcome to our very first episode of Season 5 of Indo-Techno. We're really pleased to invite back a returning guest for a bird's eye view of Indonesia's tech industry, and specifically its prospects of delivering more of its startups to IPO and beyond. Andy Tai is the head of Southeast Asia investment banking at Goldman Sachs. Thanks a bunch for returning to the show, Andy.
Hey, Alan. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back on the show.
It's great to have you back. Now, Andy, you last joined us exactly 3 years ago in October of 2020. I'm going to go easy on you with a nice, broad softball question for you. What has changed as you look at the tech startup landscape in Indonesia in those intervening 3 years?
It's interesting. I think a lot of things have happened over the last 3 years. More importantly, the universe of large tech companies within Southeast Asia and Indonesia as well has expanded quite significantly. A few of these are obviously publicly traded today, which is good for the overall ecosystem. And lastly, I would say is in terms of mind shift, we're seeing a lot more companies being focused on profitability rather than the historic growth at all cost mentality.
Got you. Now, I remember the actual focus of our October 2020 episode was SPACs or special purpose acquisition companies. I'm hopefully not exaggerating in saying that the experience with this alternative to the traditional IPO has been quite jarring, with possibly all of those tech companies delivered by SPAC from this region, at least, still trading well below their initial pricing. What have we learned about the relevance of the SPAC to Indonesia and Southeast Asia since then?
I think the key part around the SPAC transactions is probably the ability to transition from a private to public company, in the sense that when you become a public company, you have a larger universe of public investors that you need to cater to. And more importantly, public investors expect, one, I think, accountability for companies in terms of delivering what they promise to the market. Secondly, which is actually more important, is how do you actually guide the market? What are the key benchmarks that you should be talking to investors about? That's going to be very important as well in terms of investor relations that typically a lot of private companies don't really think about yet.
Those are some really good points, because I've only come to market through the traditional IPO route, and you're very keenly aware of what is decades, if not frankly more than 100 years of relationship cultivation by these institutions like Goldman Sachs. And SPACs are on the other side of the spectrum. They're led by one or two or at most three individuals who may be incredibly accomplished, but whose networks and level of sophistication with the financial markets, I would assume, simply can't rival that of an institution like a Goldman Sachs or one of its peers. And I can see those things really being laid bare when the markets turn, not to have that familiarity with the markets and that expertise and that network. Now, I have another big picture question for you, Andy. One of the biggest tectonic shifts in the Indonesian tech startup community was the abrupt shift from growth to profitability. You referenced it earlier in our discussion. Tell me what this shift has done to a majority of the startup landscape, beyond the obvious changes to growth trajectory. Basically, okay, we're not going to go growth. We're going to try to make profit. Therefore, our growth is probably going to slow. But what's other less obvious color and anecdotes that you can share?
I think on that point, as you mentioned, companies are more focused around profitability. But I would say to the quality of the profitability, it's very important investors, right? In the tech space, obviously, we historically talked about, for example, LTV to CAC as a metric to think about the efficiency and path to profitability for companies. I think most companies are even more focused around that already. So it's not just cutting costs in terms of cutting headcount, cutting marketing spend, but even for the decreased marketing spend that most companies are working on right now, how do we actually maximize the efficiency of marketing spend? That's where I think companies are being a bit more thoughtful. On the same point around what are the other changes as people think about profitability, I do think that people are also thinking about ancillary type revenue opportunities to what they're doing today. Not specific growth per se, but more about if I have the same budget, what can I be doing more to, again, make use of efficient capital allocation to drive more profitability?
You mentioned LTV. Can you describe for our audience what LTV to CAC stands for?
Sure. So LTV to CAC is a very common way to calculate what we call LTV, which is lifetime value of maybe the user or customer base for a set period of time. Typically, companies use a 1 year as a metric. So you have cohorts of, call it 2022 versus cohorts of 2023. And then the denominator here, which we call CAC, is customer acquisition costs, right? The theory here is ultimately, as you spend more money to acquire customers or the CAC, the lifetime value of that 1 year cohort, for example, should have a higher value versus initial customer acquisition cost.
Understood. In this day and age, not all customers are created equal. We are looking for a customer that delivers maximal long-term value and ideally is not very expensive to acquire. So maximize that numerator, minimize the denominator, which kind of, you're really talking about the onus on the head of marketing growing significantly, not just buy eyeballs, but actually bring on humans that have wallets and will spend, not just for the first month or three, but for the longer term. Now, what other megatrends have we seen in Indonesia tech over the past 3 years? Are we seeing a lot of competitive consolidation? Are the days of intensive promotion-driven competition in areas such as e-commerce and payments over, particularly given that you've been talking about subsidies?
So a couple of key trends, I would say. One, as you alluded to, a lot more diversification from what I call traditional tech, which is e-commerce and payments. We're seeing more companies in agri-tech, for example, that's something new. We're seeing more in the SaaS space as well. So I do think that is a good evolution for Southeast Asia tech. The second thematic we're seeing a lot more is actually a focus on ESG as well. And I think that is a important criteria for a lot of investors, and the companies are resonating around that thematic as well. The last thing I would say is to your point around consolidation. We do expect that in an environment like this, consolidation, rationalization of the markets of competition is actually a very good tool as well for companies to really defend their market share or even grow their market share as well. So I do expect a lot more M&A to happen as well.
Andy, what other broad trends are you witnessing?
So one other trend that I would want to mention as well, so we spend a lot of time talking about the companies and the tech ecosystem. Maybe it's also a good point to highlight, I think, the increasing diversity of the investor base for tech companies. So historically, as we talked about, we would go to sovereign wealth funds, private equity, venture funds to think about equity-like solutions or funding for tech companies. What I'm seeing right now, it's a lot more diversity in terms of we're actually seeing a lot more credit funds, special situations funds, wanting to actually get exposure to the tech ecosystem. We're also seeing a lot more family offices being more open around not just straight equity deals, but structured deals as well. So I think that's a good sign that the ecosystem is evolving.
Fascinating. And it's got to be a good thing because they each probably carry different criteria. And as a listed company, you're always looking to have a diversified investor base. So a full year or two prior to our 2020 podcast, many were declaring the quote-unquote golden era of Southeast Asia tech. Not sure if much of this has eventuated as of October 2023. What is lacking for Indonesia and the region to resume delivery of its best tech companies to the public markets, Andy?
I think the couple of factors, I think most importantly is scale. As we think about the universe of companies that want to go public or are public, obviously they are large, scalable businesses. As I mentioned, I do think M&A will help drive a lot more consolidation and hopefully help companies scale up. So that's going to be important. The second thing which I alluded to as well is a pivot from being a private company to a public company is not easy. And for a lot of companies, we're seeing that learning phase around how to guide investors, how to guide capital markets, being a public company. And that's, again, as I mentioned, requires a significant mind shift.
Yeah, I have to say, I do a lot of that work advising companies for the financial markets and for the eventual IPO these days. And it's refreshing and redeeming to hear that you're seeing that need also. Now, We've had a couple of Indonesia's larger tech companies first list domestically on the IDX, but with plans to conduct a secondary listing in the US at some later point in time, basically creating a dual listing between Indonesia and the US. Speaking as generically as makes you comfortable, how feasible are secondary listings out of Indonesia and into the US currently, and what might be impeding progress, if anything?
I would say there is actually by precedence of secondary listing. If you look at Telkom Indonesia, they are listed both in the US and domestically as well. So there's precedence. And more important, precedence means there's structure and there's a way to actually do these deals. I do think it's a matter of time before we see a large universe of companies being dual listed. You get liquidity in US and also brand recognition and domestic exchanges. So it's a nice to have for being on both sides of a listing venue. To answer your question around when do these happen, I just do think that it's just a timing issue for the market. Like I mentioned, in the US, you probably need a greater emphasis on scale. So for a lot of these companies, they're still busy scaling up. More importantly, we are in an environment where everyone's taking a wait-and-see approach. So I think it's just a function of when the market is ready for dual listings.
Got you. But there are no significant legal or other kind of material blockages which would prevent us from considering this, tax considerations, et cetera?
Taxes, I think, an impact on valuation. So I do think companies are trying to optimize their tax structure. But to answer your question around framework, around governance and things like that, I don't see any significant issues, actually.
That's really encouraging. Now, you've been advising entrepreneurs on the financial markets for many years. In fact, well before you worked with us at C Group throughout 2017 on our IPO onto the New York Stock Exchange. How has your advice to the aspiring Indonesian entrepreneur changed over the years?
So I think to the Indonesian entrepreneur, I would say a couple of things today and that may be slightly different. One is, as we talked about, focus around more profitability rather than growth at all cost. And so unit economics, LTV, the CAC is more important than ever right now. Second thing is, as we think about competition, the nuances around barrier to entry is still fairly important. And the last thing I would say too to the Indonesia entrepreneur is people do care a lot more today about the quality of management and the diversity of the management team as well. So to the extent that we think a lot of businesses are founder-led, that's good and great. And people like the visionary entrepreneur. But the ability to showcase and demonstrate a deep bench at the management level is going to be very important in Indonesia.
That's fascinating. Both you and I have more than a passing familiarity with the steady maturation in management in a much larger market like China and China's tech space over the past 20 years. And I would agree, Indonesia can only benefit as its leaders become more and more seasoned and as the leadership teams become even broader shouldered. Now, we've over the years spent a lot of time talking about Southeast Asia tech as a beneficiary of the deterioration of Sino-US relations. Can you share any good examples of how the region has materially benefited?
I think the advantages to Southeast Asia are a couple fold. One, increase capital access. We're seeing a lot more historically China-focused VCs coming to this region, looking to deploy in Southeast Asia investments. Second thing I would say is, as you mentioned, more strategic interests, both from an M&A standpoint, as well as organic expansion into regions. We're having a lot more dialogues with Chinese strategics as they think about how to play into Southeast Asia. And the last thing I would mention as well is really around more cross-border flows as well, in the sense that particularly for a lot of the e-commerce transactions, we're seeing a lot more southbound e-commerce transactions from China into Southeast Asia. Similarly, we're seeing a lot more Southeast Asia merchants trying to actually access China as well. And I think that's going to be a very interesting growth TAM that's coming.
Very interesting. So there seem to be a number of angles to this. But where, on the contrary, has this assumption that capital and interest might actively be shifting from that Sino-US spectrum to Southeast Asia? Where has it proved hollow? Where maybe has it disappointed or not met expectations?
Taking a step back, we do see a lot of Chinese strategic financial investor interest in Southeast Asia. I'm not saying that 100% of it, by the way, is tied to US-China decoupling. A lot of the Chinese activity we're seeing now is just they're fundamentally interested in Southeast Asia as a region to expand in above and beyond their domestic markets, because it's in some ways the closest geographically. There are a lot of cultural similarities as well. So that's driving a lot of interest, I think, southbound. Then in terms of expectations, I do feel that it's just a matter of time. Where people have been overly excited was how fast the historically Chinese-focused money would be deployed into Southeast Asia. I do think in the last couple of months, it has been slightly slower than what people have expected. Based on the various dialogues we're having, I do expect more interest and more deal activity as well from that pool of capital.
It's encouraging to hear. Now, Andy, maybe somewhat a bit of a follow-up here. Clearly, monetization is king. You've talked about it. You're seeing management teams pursue profitability and monetization over simple growth in users. In which verticals have we seen that all-important dynamic of monetization surprise on the upside?
So I think on the upside, where people have been more surprised, I would say, is broad verticals is really around e-commerce. Historically, e-commerce had, I think, a not positive reputation in some ways, where people think that it's a lot of subsidy-driven. That was what driving engagement. I would say where I think there's been surprise, at least in my mind, was as we look through the markets where everyone's rationalizing on costs and subsidies per se, the e-commerce market has been fairly resilient. People are still spending, and for a lot of companies, we're seeing profitability as well for e-commerce transactions. So that's going to be, I think, very important. The other sector I would say that we've seen upside more broadly is around payments and lending as well, especially in an environment where people feel the macro is somewhat more challenged. We're still seeing payment and lending companies actually churning out good cash flows from their businesses as well.
Okay. As I know them, e-commerce and fintech are effectively the first and second largest parts of a tech ecosystem for most markets. So that's really encouraging. I wanted to ask you, where have our assumptions around monetization possibly proved overly optimistic?
As we look through the whole landscape, the merchant-focused, SME-focused sectors have been somewhat more challenged. Initially, people were focused around B2B, and I think rightly so. In most sectors, B2B is a very interesting market. However, that said, as we look through the whole landscape, I would say that particularly that sector, B2B, merchant, SME focus, in terms of expectations, a lot of companies have not been able to scale up and drive good economics. And that's something I think investors are very focused around.
Thanks for that. Now, you mentioned earlier that continued improvement in corporate governance is critical to Indonesia's prospects to IPO. What would you say is the state of corporate governance across the Indo-tech scene currently?
I would say governance is a fairly good level, whereby I do genuinely feel entrepreneurs want to do the right thing, both for the company and their shareholders. If you ask me any areas of improvement, it's really just increased communication and guidance for their shareholders. And by the way, this is not, I would say, an Indonesian-specific issue. It's a high-growth tech company issue in some ways, where people are focused around executing a business plan, trying to improve the business, gain market share. But in terms of just communication with their shareholders, feels a bit sometimes, in some cases, secondary consideration. So where I think there may be rooms for improvement is most companies may want to consider hiring someone who is focused on investor relations and be able to more effectively communicate with their shareholders as well.
Gotcha. Andy, I wanted to wrap up asking you another broad question. You've communicated with all of the major institutional investors that would buy a new IPO out of Indonesia or Southeast Asia. What does the startup founder need to know of these criteria that might surprise him or her?
I think holistically, putting aside criteria, what we have constantly been seeing is founders are just surprised at how much work and preparation it takes for a company to transition from a private to public market. So from a private to public company, right? You need your accounting to be audited in line with the new financial accounting standards. You need to set up the corporate governance internal controls. You need to have a very clear and precise communication and guidance to the market. So it's not just one specific issue, I would say, that surprises founders. I think where people struggle is getting the resources and really have an understanding that becoming a public company takes a lot more than the existing resources that most companies have today.
Yeah, man, I would have to agree to that. And it's always so good for us to be able to come back to this wellspring of expertise on the tech financial market that you and Goldman Sachs have cultivated. I specifically found your discussion of the incredible increase in the importance of and the scrutiny around the incremental marketing dollar spent by the tech startup really interesting. That was not the case 3 or 4 years ago. I'm also really encouraged to see you confirm that agritech and ESG are trends to watch out for, as we have reps from both of these categories in our podcast pipeline. And finally, your unvarnished views on corporate governance and also the massive undertaking that is preparing a company to go to the public markets. These two insights should really be an important input for the aspiring CEO. Thanks again for joining.
Thank you, Alan, for having me on. It's always good to be on.
You're very welcome. We hope our listeners have enjoyed today's episode. As always, please consider sharing any feedback that you have about the Indotechno podcast with us. Terima kasih. Sampai jumpa lagi.